Chapter 3. Reading of print and handwriting on second-hand impression. Thus fiction is nearer truth. But let that pass. A historian may be an artist too, and a novelist is a historian, the preserver, the keeper, the expounder of human experience. As is meet for a man of his descent and tradition, Mr. Henry James is the historian of fine consciences. Of course, this is a general statement, but I don't think its truth will be, or can be, questioned. Its fault is that it leaves so much out, and, besides, Mr. Henry James is much too considerable to be put into the nutshell of a phrase. The fact remains that he has made his choice, and that his choice is justified up to the hilt by the success of his art. He has taken for himself the greater part. The range of a fine conscience covers more good and evil than the range of conscience which may be called, roughly, not fine. A conscience, less troubled by the nice discrimination of shades of conduct. A fine conscience is more concerned with essentials. Its triumphs are more perfect, if less profitable, in a worldly sense. There is, in short, more truth in its working for a historian, to detect and to show. It is a thing of infinite complication and suggestion. None of these escapes the art of Mr. Henry James. He has mastered the country, his domain, not wild indeed, but full of romantic glimpses, of deep shadows and sunny places. There are no secrets left within his range. He has disclosed them as they should be disclosed, that is, beautifully. And, indeed, ugliness has but little place in this world of his creation. Yet, it is always felt in the truthfulness of his art. It is there, it surrounds the scene, it presses close upon it. It is made visible, tangible, in the struggles, in the contacts of the fine consciences, in their perplexities, in the sophism of their mistakes. For a fine conscience is naturally a virtuous one. What is natural about it is just its fineness, an abiding sense of the intangible, ever-present, right. It is most visible in their ultimate triumph, in their emergence from miracle, through an energetic act of renunciation. Energetic, not violent. The distinction is wide, enormous, like that between substance and shadow. Through it all, Mr. Henry James keeps a firm hold of the substance, of what is worth having, of what is worth holding. The contrary opinion has been, if not absolutely affirmed, than at least implied, with some frequency. To most of us, living willingly in a sort of intellectual moonlight, in the faintly reflected light of truth, the shadows so firmly renounced by Mr. Henry James men and women, stand out endowed with extraordinary value, with a value so extraordinary, that their rejection offends, by its uncalled-for scrupulousness, those business-like instincts which a careful providence has implanted in our breasts. And, apart from that just cause of discontent, it is obvious that a solution by rejection must always present a certain lack of finality, especially startling when contrasted with the usual methods of solution by rewards and punishments, by crowned love, by fortune, by a broken leg or a sudden death. Why, the reading public which, as a body, has never laid upon a storyteller the command to be an artist, should demand from him this sham of divine omnipotence, is utterly incomprehensible. But so it is, and these solutions are legitimate, inasmuch as they satisfy the desire for finality, for which our hearts yearn with a longing greater than the longing for the loaves and fishes of this earth. Perhaps the only true desire of mankind, coming thus to light in its hours of leisure, is to be set at rest. One is never set at rest by Mr. Henry James' novels. His books end as an episode in life ends. You remain with the sense of the life still going on, and even the subtle presence of the dead is felt in that silence that comes upon the artist's creation when the last word has been read. It is eminently satisfying, but it is not final. Mr. Henry James, great artist and faithful historian, never attempts the impossible. Elphin's Daughter, 1898. It is sweet to talk decorously of the dead who are part of our past, our indisputable possession. One must admit regretfully that today is but a scramble, that tomorrow may never come. It is only the precious yesterday that cannot be taken away from us. A gift from the dead, great and little, it makes life supportable. It almost makes one believe in a benevolent scheme of creation. And some kind of belief is very necessary. But the real knowledge of matters infinitely more profound than any conceivable scheme of creation is with the dead alone. That is why our talk about them should be as decorous as their silence. Their generosity and their discretion deserve nothing less at our hands, and they, who belong already to the unchangeable, would probably disdain to claim more than this from a mankind that changes its loves and its hates about every 25 years at the coming of every new and wiser generation. One of the most generous of the dead is Dodet, who, with a prodigality approaching magnificence, gave himself up to us without reserve in his work, with all his qualities and all his faults. Neither his qualities nor his faults were great, though they were by no means imperceptible. It is only his generosity that is out of the common. What strikes one most in his work is the disinterestedness of the toiler. With more talent than many bigger men, he did not preach about himself. He did not attempt to persuade mankind into a belief of his own greatness. He never posed as a scientist, or as a seer, not even as a prophet, and he neglected his interests to the point of never propounding a theory for the purpose of giving a tremendous significance to his art, alone of all things, in a world that, by some strange oversight, has not been supplied with an obvious meaning. Neither did he affect a passive attitude before the spectacle of life, an attitude which in gods and in a rare mortal here and there may appear godlike, but assumed by some men, causes one, very unwillingly, to think of the melancholy quietude of an ape. He was not the wearisome expounder of this or that theory, here today and spurned tomorrow. He was not a great artist, he was not an artist at all, if you like, but he was Elphinstonet, a man as naively clear, honest, and vibrating as the sunshine of his native land, that regrettably undiscriminating sunshine which matures grapes and pumpkins alike, and cannot, of course, obtain the commendation of the very select who look at life from under a parasol. Naturally, being a man from the South, he had a rather outspoken belief in himself, but a small distinction, worth many a greater, was in not being in bondage to some vanishing creed. He was a worker who could not compel the admiration of the few, but who deserved the affection of the many, and he may be spoken of with tenderness and regret, for he is not immortal, he is only dead. During his life the simple man whose business it ought to have been to climb, in the name of art, some elevation or other, was content to remain below, on the plain, amongst his creations, and take an eager part in those disasters, weaknesses, and joys which are tragic enough in their droll way, but are by no means so momentous and profound as some writers probably for the sake of art would like to make us believe. There is, when one thinks of it, a considerable want of candor in the august view of life. Without doubt a cautious reticence on the subject, or even a delicately false suggestion thrown out in that direction is, in a way, praiseworthy, since it helps to uphold the dignity of man a matter of great importance, as anyone can see. Still one cannot help feeling that a certain amount of sincerity would not be wholly blamable. To state, then, with studied moderation a belief that in unfortunate moments of lucidity is irresistibly borne in upon most of us the blind agitation caused mostly by hunger, and complicated by love and ferocity does not deserve either by its beauty, or its morality, or its possible results, the artistic fuss made over it. It may be consoling, for human folly is very bizarre, but it is scarcely honest to shout at those who struggle drowning in an insignificant pool. You are indeed admirable and great to be the victims of such a profound, of such a terrible ocean. And Dodet was honest, perhaps because he knew no better, but he was very honest. If he saw only the surface of things, it is for the reason that most things have nothing but a surface. He did not pretend, perhaps, because he did not know how he did not pretend to see any depths in a life that is only a film of unsteady appearances stretched over regions deep indeed, but which have nothing to do with the half-truths, half-thoughts, and whole illusions of existence. The road to these distant regions does not lie through the domain of art or the domain of science, where well-known voices quarrel noisily in a misty emptiness. It is a path of toilsome silence upon which travel men simple and unknown, with closed lips, or, maybe, whispering their pain softly only to themselves. But Daudet did not whisper. He spoke loudly, with animation, with a clear felicity of tone as a bird sings. He saw life around him with extreme clearness, and he felt it as it is thinner than air, and more elusive than a flash of lightning. He hastened to offer it his compassion, his indignation, his wonder, his sympathy, without giving a moment of thought to the momentous issues that are supposed to lurk in the logic of such sentiments. He tolerated the little foibles, the small ruffianisms, the grave mistakes. The only thing he distinctly would not forgive was hardness of heart. This unpractical attitude would have been fatal to a better man, but his readers have forgiven him. With Ali is chivalrous to exiled queens and deformed sempstresses, he is pityingly tender to broken down actors, to ruined gentlemen, to stupid academicians. He is glad of the joys of the commonplace people in a commonplace way, and he never makes a secret of all this. No, the man was not an artist. What if his creations are illumined by the sunshine of his temperament so vividly that they stand before us infinitely more real than the dingy illusions surrounding our everyday existence? The misguided man is forever pottering amongst them, lifting up his voice, dotting his eyes in the wrong places. He takes Tartarin by the arm, he does not conceal his interest in the nabob's checks, his sympathy for an honest academician plus BK nature, his hate for an architect plus mauvais K la gale. He is in the thick of it all. He feels with the Duc de Mora, and with Felicia eyes, and he lets you see it. He does not sit on the pedestal in the hieratic and imbecile pose of some cheap god whose greatness consists in being too stupid to care. He cares immensely for his nabobs, his kings, his bookkeepers, his colettes, and his sapphos. He vibrates together with his universe, and with lamentable simplicity, follows M. de Montpavin on that last walk along the boulevards. Monsieur de Montpavin Marchi la Mort, and the creator of that unlucky gentilhomme, follows with stealthy footsteps, with wide eyes, with an impressively pointing finger. And who wouldn't look? But it is hard. It is sometimes very hard to forgive him the dotted eyes, the pointing finger, this making plain of obvious mysteries. Monsieur de Montpavin Marchi la Mort, and presently, on the crowded pavement, takes off his hat with punctilious courtesy to the doctor's wife, who, elegant and unhappy, is bound on the same pilgrimage. This is too much. We feel we cannot forgive him such meetings, the constant whisper of his presence. We feel we cannot, till suddenly the very naivety of it all touches us with the revealed suggestion of a truth. Then we see that the man is not false. All this is done in transparent good faith. The man is not melodramatic. He is only picturesque. He may not be an artist, but he comes as near the truth as some of the greatest. His creations are seen. You can look into their very eyes, and these are as thoughtless as the eyes of any wise generation that has in its hands the fame of writers. Yes, they are seen, and the man who is not an artist is seen also commiserating, indignant, joyous, human and alive in their very midst. Inevitably they march in de la mort, and they are very near the truth of our common destiny. Their fate is poignant, it is intensely interesting, and of not the slightest consequence. Guy de Maupassant, 1904-1. To introduce Maupassant to English readers with apologetic explanations, as though his art were recondite, and the tendency of his work immoral would be a gratuitous impertinence. Maupassant's conception of his art is such as one would expect from a practical and resolute mind. but in the consummate simplicity of his technique it ceases to be perceptible. This is one of its greatest qualities, and like all the great virtues it is based primarily on self-denial. To pronounce a judgment upon the general tendency of an author is a difficult task. One could not depend upon reason alone, nor yet trust solely to one's emotions. Used together, they would in many cases traverse each other, because emotions have their own unanswerable logic. Our capacity for emotion is limited, and the field of our intelligence is restricted. Responsiveness to every feeling, combined with the penetration of every intellectual subterfuge, would end, not in judgment, but in universal absolution. Tout comprendre qu'est tout pardonner. And in this benevolent neutrality towards the warring errors of human nature all light would go out from art and from life. We are at liberty then, to quarrel with Maupassant's attitude towards our world in which, like the rest of us, he has that share which his senses are able to give him. But we need not quarrel with him violently. If our feelings, which are tender, happen to be hurt, because his talent is not exercised for the praise and consolation of mankind, our intelligence, which is great, should let us see that he is a very splendid sinner, like all those who in this valley of compromises err by over-devotion to the truth that is in them. His determinism, barren of praise, blame and consolation, has all the merit of his conscientious art. The worth of every conviction consists precisely in the steadfastness with which it is held. Except for his philosophy, which in the case of so consummate an artist does not matter unless to the solemn and naive mind, Maupassant of all writers of fiction demands least forgiveness from his readers. He does not require forgiveness, because he is never dull. The interest of a reader in a work of imagination is either ethical, or that of simple curiosity. Both are perfectly legitimate, since there is both a moral and an excitement to be found in a faithful rendering of life. And in Maupassant's work there is the interest of curiosity, and the moral of a point of view consistently preserved, and never obtruded for the end of personal gratification. The spectacle of this immense talent served by exceptional faculties, and triumphing over the most thankless subjects by an unswerving singleness of purpose is in itself an admirable lesson in the power of artistic honesty, one may say of artistic virtue. The inherent greatness of the man consists in this, that he will let none of the fascinations that beset a writer working in loneliness turn him away from the straight path, from the vouchsafed vision of excellence. He will not be led into perdition by the seductions of sentiment, of eloquence, of humor, of pathos, of all that splendid pageant of faults that pass between the writer and his probity on the blank sheet of paper, like the glittering cordage of deadly sins before the austere anchorite in the desert air of Thebaid. This is not to say that Maupassant's austerity has never faltered. But the fact remains that no tempting demon has ever succeeded in hurling him down from his high, if narrow, pedestal. It is the austerity of his talent, of course, that is in question. Let the discriminating reader, who at times may well spare a moment or two to the consideration and enjoyment of artistic excellence, be asked to reflect a little upon the texture of two stories included in this volume. Piece of String, and Sail. How many openings the last offers for the gratuitous display of the author's wit or clever buffoonery, the first for an unmeasured display of sentiment. And both sentiment and buffoonery could have been made very good too, in a way accessible to the meanest intelligence, at the cost of truth and honesty. Here it is where Maupassant's austerity comes in. He refrains from setting his cleverness against the eloquence of the facts. There is humor and pathos in these stories, but such is the greatness of his talent, the refinement of his artistic conscience, that all his high qualities appear inherent in the very things of which he speaks, as if they had been altogether independent of his presentation. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.